go. Michael Mike Smith, who is the author of two pieces of evidence, a statement dated the 23rd of July and then a piece of rebuttal the 22nd of August. Mike's also prepared a summary, which I understand you already have, but we'll read that now and then answer questions.
Thank you, Commissioners. Just in my summary, my evidence relates to specific relief sought by submitters in relation to PDP, Chapter 29, Transport. Just an overarching comment there, recognition that Chapter 29 seeks to achieve an integrated, safe and efficient transport network that provides for all transport modes, reduces the dependency on private motor vehicle and promotes the use of shared public and active transport. Just going through some of the following key matters in my evidence. The first one, Rule 29.5.22, which is in relation to the minimum distance of vehicle crossings from intersections, in relation to which I consider that the nature and the scale of the proposed development may have a significant effect on the safe operation of a road. I consider that the assessment criteria for this rule should be easy to understand from a layperson's perspective, and therefore consider that the posted legal speed limit for a road should be used, not the operating speed, as it is the clearest method for determination of a breach of the rule. Number two, Table 29.8, car parking sizes and layouts. Where I'm cautious about adopting Australia New Zealand Standard 2890.1 2004 as the standard for aisle dimension. 2890.1 2004 was last reviewed in 2004 and was based on an evaluation of an Australian vehicle fleet that was registered in the year 2000. I consider that this standard should provide an absolute minimum dimensions acceptable only when taking an assessment to adequate parking dimensions. Number three, Table 29.2, heavy vehicle parking layout standards. In relation to which I note that there is a mechanism proposed in Rule 29.5.2, 29.5.7, and 29.5.10 that allows the consideration of a pass-fail test for the application, along with the mechanism for the demonstration of a suitable layout utilising tracking of vehicles should that application fail the initial test. In my view, reliance on tracking curves only should not be determinative of compliance for an application. And item four, parking rates, where I recognise and support the Council's aims to facilitate a modal shift and reduce the traffic impact on the road and network. In my rebuttal evidence, I indicate that I'm cautious about adopting a blanket 1-5 ratio, MPO ratio for the hotel style accommodation, due to the absence of published data to clarify what the appropriate parking requirements are for that type of activity. However, a stepped approach to reduction in parking rates would be appropriate depending on the threshold level.
Thank you. I've only got one question, so I'll ask that first. In your main brief of evidence, on page 5, talking about fire service provisions, fire service submissions, and you referred to various matters there, I was just wondering whether gradient may also be an issue, gradient of access.
Gradient of access for heavy fire service vehicle?
Yes, full of water.
Certainly. typically a fire engine is carrying somewhere between 10 to 15,000 litres, so that's 10 to 15 tonne of water. Gradient is an issue, but my understanding is that the fire service equip their vehicles to the terrain that they operate in. So therefore a vehicle that might be applicable to an urban environment may not be applicable to Queenstown. So that the vehicles are geared more towards the environment that they operate in. But certainly gradient will have an issue on speed of trip and the excessively steep gradients, especially in combination with Queenstown, Wanaka, where we have the extreme weather events, icing, all of those things, they are all interrelated.
Well, I raise it because I have various other hearings been told that the Hidden Hills subdivision on the side of Mount Iron, fire service vehicles may not be able to get up there, and whether our transport provision should be ensuring that those sorts of subdivisions at least make special provision of fire service vehicles can't get there.
I think I agree, and in part that's the reason for the inclusion of access for fire vehicles, because that opens the determination up.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
Just while we're on that, I'll jump in. On that page, which is your point 314, you refer to Rule 29.514 and access for emergency service facilities. And it was amended, and it doesn't seem to have made it to the amendment.
No, it should probably be vehicle facility.
It hasn't ended up being in the Johns' version, but it's just.
I think you probably saw that. That sounds like an omission on our behalf. So we can pull together it. This is a matter of discretion.
Discretion is restricted to effects on safety, efficiency, pedestrian cycling environment, and access for emergency service vehicles, which didn't make it into the motion.
That's right.
Why what on the assessment matters?
Assessment matters. Can we come back to you on that?
Yeah.
Yes. No, absolutely.
No.
Because.
Yes, just you've commented that you were cautious about adopting the ASNT standard for aisle dimensions. Is that because since that time the high proportion of bigger vehicles, like pushy bees, that kind of thing, is that behind your thinking or some other thing?
Partially. I do voice a concern or a caution, and that we're looking at an Australian New Zealand standard, which is a global standard for all environments. And we're looking at something here in Queenstown, which is often quite specific. If we look at the
Queenstown Lakes.
Sorry, Queenstown Lakes. If we look at the vehicle fleet, some of the studies that have and numbers that have been presented for various hearings I've been involved with here have a higher proportion of larger vehicles in the rental fleet than elsewhere. Similarly, there may be a higher proportion of larger size vehicles in amongst the community itself because of the nature of the terrain where they may be more adventurous in getting out to the remote areas. The other caution is 2004 is now getting quite a long distance away, and there have been improvements in vehicles, so power steering and the like have made improvements, but the size of vehicle has changed as well. So I think I do add caution to it because it may not be relevant. We haven't, because it's so long ago that it's been reviewed, there's no test to say that it's currently relevant.
The other two questions, I suppose, almost derived from interest, but I take you to the right point to ask about roads and hierarchy.
I've got an interest in it, but I wouldn't say I'm the expert of it.
Okay. Just interesting, on page 2946 of my copy, and it relates to, you've got the list of all the arterial roads and various road classifications. And just out of interest, I know that Industrial Place, which is a cul-de-sac, the way this reads, I think I've got it right, is an arterial road. Is it normal for an industrial cul-de-sac to be classified as an arterial road?
Often the classification comes from the volume and type of vehicle utilising the road. Without looking specifically into that one in the table, I'm sorry I couldn't give you an exact answer. But it does come from a number of variables.
I've always understood arterials are roads where the primary traffic function is movement on access.
That is correct.
And it's to get you from A to B, which is a cul-de-sac. I'm pretty sure I initially thought I was reading it wrong. It's actually referring to Gorge Road, but it's not. It says industrial place from Gorge Road to the end of industrial place. I've never heard of an industrial cul-de-sac that was primarily there to buy access being classified as an arterial. It just seems extraordinary.
That doesn't have a storage depot being like an oil refinery or something like that.
Or a port.
Like I say, I haven't had a look into it, but I would refer back to council staff and have a look at it and see if we can answer it for you.
Yes, just another one I was of interest too, with the road west of Wanaka towards the Mount Aspiring Road, is the road right out to Raspberry Flat is classified as a collector. Now when you get the last 5 k's of that, it's basically a goat track. And again, I mean, can you classify goat tracks as a collector road?
It's a very busy goat.
It's a busy road.
It's got a very...
Well, maybe you can. I'm just a little surprised, that's all.
I do know a little bit about this one. The original assessment for Mount Aspiring Road was sectionised a little bit differently from what it is now. I think the recommendation was to keep some consistency along its route. I am aware of a rather large facility at the end of the road, which gets used quite frequently. I think it was more around consistency, because otherwise we would have to find a logical place along the route to break that classification.
Yeah, I would have thought it was where the Treble Coat Ski Field Road marks up would be the logical end of it. But again, I'm not losing sleep over this, but just seemed a bit odd on the face of it, that's all. Other than that, anybody have any questions?
Which segues beautifully into my question. Do you agree with the Chief Executive's reclassification of Wanaka Mount Aspiring Road and it becoming a collector road from McDougall Street through a variety of different roading surfaces, ending up in a goat track, I'm told?
Mount Aspiring Road is what we would term a spider road. It sort of goes out and back, and it does service a number of little sub-roads that come off. And also mindful of some of the activities that do occur in and around there. I think for classification purposes, it's probably easy to keep it as a collector. The level of control that it's on the collector status is better than a local road status. So it just gives a little bit more control around what can actually be done.
It'll cease to become a special purpose road. Because it used to be, it was all the great, there was one out at the Great Works as well, and the same classification. So special.
The other question I had on that, what I thought Commissioner McLeod was going to ask, is Raspberry Flat in West Wanaka or West Mantoki Toki?
Sorry, I didn't hear that, sorry.
Is Raspberry Flat in West Wanaka, as it says on the table, or West Mantoki Toki?
I couldn't answer that, sorry.
Well, maybe you'll ask Mr. James that question.
In your main evidence about the code of practice, the subdivision code of practice, and the importance of referring to it. I don't know whether you were involved with the subdivision chapter, because I wasn't. The code of practice in relation to this transport chapter doesn't seem to have a major role. I can only find one place where it's referred to in the transport chapter, and that's in a rule regarding access and road design, which only applies actually outside roads, so it's really about access design. I don't know quite how it would apply to road design, because the road design's really done in the subdivision chapter. Can you just clarify for me that the code of practice is also referred to in the subdivision chapter? That its primary role is possibly there, as opposed to its use in this transport chapter?
In answer to your first question, no, unfortunately I wasn't involved in the subdivision chapter.
Okay.
With regards to the code of practice and its relevance to a road, often with applications that we get, there are elements within the code of practice that we refer to. The junction of an accessway into an existing road infrastructure would fit in both.
Yes.
So we look at the form and function of that accessway. Does it handle the right amount of traffic? Is it of the right size, shape? Has it got the right approach angle? All of those elements. And then within the code of practice and the subdivision side, we also look at features like what is it, drainage, pedestrian facilities across the intersection throats and across the intersection side road, because we might actually be making a crossing facility across the main route because of the development that's occurred off the road. So a lot of them are actually interrelated.
Yeah, so Ms. Jones might be able to just help me on this, but where the activity in this chapter, they're divided into two bundles. One's the activities outside a road and one's the activities on a road. And on a road doesn't have any standards attached to it. So where the activity might be outside a road, but the vehicle access brings it onto the road, some of the matters that you might need to look at will be on the road, therefore the code of practice has to cover both the roadside and the actual entrance itself.
Yes, Mrs. Jones would be probably better to address that issue.
Yes, okay, thank you for clarifying that for me. You've talked also in your main evidence about parking requirements for unstaffed utilities, and that's fine. That's come from, I think, from the oil company's submission. When I look at it, I think, what are the requirements for staffed utilities, or do they not really need parking? And the word, there didn't seem to be any parking requirements for utilities previously. Now there are for unstaffed utilities. What do you do? Are there such things as staffed utilities?
The matter and concern at the time, as I understand, raised by the applicants was they wanted a removal of provision for parking requirement for an unstaffed facility. An unstaffed facility, as we would determine, is maybe a larger telco exchange or a submersed water sump, pump station, sewage treatment, where the general operation of that would not require anybody on site on a day-to-day type basis. But there may be a situation where it would require a little bit more heavy or intense attendance at points of time. We made reference to the smaller kiosk and the general cell point, the cell phone tower pod points and things like that, where they would generally be covered under a requirement for a temporary traffic management and a license to occupy the road. But as for a staffed facility, I haven't turned my mind to that, but a staff facility for a utility provider would probably be a larger exchange where somebody is on site permanently. And I'm sure, again, I'll defer to council staff.
As to how that might be.
That would be a different assessment matter through the consent process.
Yes, okay. All right, well, I'll check on that. Now, there's the question about posted versus operating speeds. This comes up in 29 522, which is the the distances from vehicle crossings. When I, and you've said that the standard needs to relate to the posted one, because it's a standard and we need to know clearly what it is, we can't be trying to work out what the operating speed is. But when I look at Mr. Carr's, what Mr. Carr's now suggesting, he's suggesting adding into the matters of discretion, taking into account the operating speed. So in other words, if you're not complying with the minimum distance, so it's now in a more discretionary mode, it's actually, there's an RD application, he's suggesting that the operating speed could be one of the factors to take into account, if it's particularly if it's quite different from the posted speed. Is that something that you would recommend? Or not?
In my rebuttal, in 3.3, yes. I state there, I support in principle the amendment proposed by Mr. Carr, and that it permits consideration of reduced distances between vehicle crossing and intersections as a matter of discretion. So in principle, I support it. The I guess the first part of the test is, does it pass or does it fail? And if it fails, then the onus is on the applicant to demonstrate that the reduced offset distance is safe and operable. I've also, if I just get the right...
So if you look at paragraph 3.6, all I want to know is, are you recommending this change or not? You say it's likely applicants will seek to use this type of discretion, matter of discretion, for new subdivisions where a lower posted speed is proposed, and I consider this appropriate.
I don't support the change as it was presented by Mr. Carr,
okay,
because I think that mechanism is already there. Where it doesn't comply, they can approach, make a case to council through the consenting process of what they think is safe and efficient.
Okay, so it's sort of tied up in the safe and efficient wording more generally rather than particularly honing in on this operating space.
I think there's a number of considerations that need to be taken into account for this. The offset of an access way from an intersection is vastly different if it's a single unit residential access as compared to a hotel development. And if I can refer the commissioners to Frankton Road, Hallenstein, was mentioned earlier today about a large block of land there that could be developed as a hotel. That could result in, if the New Zealand Transport Agency proceed on with the intersection change at Hallenstein, that could result in a large accessway emerging at or in that intersection. Whereas a residential access at the same point may not have the same level of impact. So
it's just one of the things to take into account.
Scale and nature of the development is certainly an issue that you'd need to consider on a case-by-case basis.
Okay, that's fine. I just wasn't clear from your recommendations. And I also really can't follow your number three of your key matters in your... about this, but so you say that I can't find any reference in those rules to table 29.2.
What I was saying there is that there are mechanisms within.
What are those mechanisms?
That is the assessment of offsets, parking space, turn movement.
So there are mechanisms in these rules that allow consideration. So they've got So each of those rules has got a pass-fail test, the standards you have to meet. Along with a mechanism for demonstration of a suitable layout, should it fail the initial test? So are you just referring to the fact that they then have to make an application and the matters of discretion would allow that to be considered?
That's correct.
Okay, so it's not an alternative standard, it's just that they can make an application.
No, the first test is a pass-fail test in the rules, and then if they can't meet that test, and as we're finding with a number of the applications coming through for resource consent now, they are doing a case-by-case analysis of the turn movements for various vehicles associated with that application.
But it would be through a resource consent and a case-by-case analysis.
That's correct.
Okay, that's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't have any further questions.
Sorry, I just... I missed one, but I was trying to get back to that point. But it was the site facilities guidelines that I mentioned before with Mr. Crosswell, and it was you, I should have been directing the question, was I noticed that in your evidence, in what's the bottom, 5.2, you refer to... No, that's not in the evidence in the name. You refer to the cycle facilities, and it's a diagram, and it's a very simple diagram that's set out in here. And then it says other layout options are presented in the cycle facility guidelines QLDC 2009, which has made its way through to the chapter. And I was just wondering how often those things need to be made up. And if it might be worthwhile, because there's no mention of, for example, of e-bikes in those facility guidelines, and whether it would be worthwhile just getting rid of the date so that any version that's updated, or do you think it requires the date?
I'm doing a lot of work in the cycle space at the moment.
Good.
And in my evidence, as a footnote on page 9, footnote 9, we make reference across to the New Zealand Transport Agency Cycle Network and Route Planning Guide 2004, the Austroads Guide. There are a number of documents that are working in the space at the moment. Your question regarding e-bikes, a standard e-bike in its own form is generally of the same size, shape, envelope as a conventional bike.
Yeah.
The issue that we're striking now is around the variant of an e-bike, and that may be a cargo bike, or it may be an extended family bike. And that space is evolving so fast at the moment that even internationally it's very difficult to keep up with the variants of cycles that are coming out. At some point in time we have to put a stake in the ground as to what was the assessment date that document was made. If I could make a comment on that, is that the cross-referencing to the NZTA Cycle Network guidance is probably the most up-to-date currently. Austroads document, again, is a document that's stamped by date, and it's only relevant at that date. And already we know that Austroads, the vehicle fleet has changed. The best we can do is identify what dates that those documents relate to, but also have that ability to look across the other documents that are relevant to it. So if I was to say anything, it would be that it's an ever-evolving process very rapidly, but a single document on its own could be cautious.
Which is makes more... grist for the mill about putting a date on the one that we've got in the pond. Thank you. That's it. Thank you, sir.
I have got another question. I alluded to this before, we have the afternoon adjournment, so we'll finish with that.
Absolutely.
Mr. Dawson was asking you about the subdivision code of practice. The Chapter 29 specifies that Section 3 in Appendices E and F of the code of practice are incorporated into the chapter. Are those parts of the code of practice parts that don't change very often?
I think this is a matter that Ms. Jones will be able to speak to as well.
Well, I'm hoping that one someone can help it.
So she has, I think she makes the comment that at least one of those parts, is it 3.2, Ms. Jones, hasn't actually changed at all. And with the new, sorry, the recent update to the code of practice, there's been no substantive change between those,
right,
that particular part.
Okay.
So but she does address that in her evidence in chief and rebuttal. So.
Yes, because I'm just reflecting on what happened in chapter 27 where the council. Council's advice was that it changed so frequently that it was inappropriate for it to be included.
I think that
and adopted.
And that's probably a different question to the one that we've got here, because we, Ms. Jones will talk to this as well,
yeah,
but the parts of the COP that are proposed now to be incorporated by reference are less than what were originally proposed.
Well, I realise that, but that they're also less changeable, I take it.
I would assume so, if they haven't been updated with the recent round of
updates. Okay. All right. Thank you,
Mr. Thank you. Is now an appropriate time for the break, then?
Yes, well, the June's good.